To all the wanderers,
wanderers,
free thinkers,
and throwaway kids,
welcome to the dumpster fire.
Let's get dumpster diving.
We are back. We're live again.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
Yeah, yeah. Our resident Viking, our cephalopod liaison, our pyrotechnics expert, all here together today. You know, we're full stag, just us guys.
Yeah.
Just an exciting news.
Yeah.
They're recognizing lobsters and cephalopods as sentient beings.
I saw that.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I can see the cephalopods.
I don't see the lobster.
I've not met a lot of sentient lobsters.
Yeah.
There's actually a... Let me see if I can find it real quick. I just read a list of ways to say someone was daydreaming.
Yes, it's fantastic.
And one of them was something about crabs. So pondering the crab's immortality in Mexican Spanish is saying someone is daydreaming. I think my favorite is dreaming of green horses on walls. That's Romanian.
Interesting.
Yeah. Huh. So
neat.
Yeah, I think lobsters and crabs, correct me if I'm wrong, they have indeterminate growth and they don't age. There's something about their cells that doesn't break down.
Yeah, I believe it's lobsters that they're technically immortal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
if nothing kills them.
Outside force, they're immortal.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of crab species. And technically, through carcinization, we would all, on a long enough timeline, become crabs.
We would become crab. We came from crabs. We would return to crabs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, guys, today we were supposed to do mead, but Morticia Adams couldn't make it. And she has her own mead horn and all. So, Michael, I'm sorry we had to switch it up at the last minute, but I've got a fun one. I've got a cool one. It's a limited release. It's
nice.
Maker's Mark.
I've seen that.
101. Yeah, check the bottle out.
It's nice.
It looks like a traditional Maker's Mark bottle, but it doesn't have a paper label at all. It's got some like gold scroll.
Yeah.
Very interesting on the front of that.
Nice.
Yeah. Now, I looked this up because I was like, what's the deal with 101? There's a Maker's Mark 46. This only comes out every now and again. The 101 does. And it's the same thing as standard Maker's Mark. It's 70% corn, that 16% red winter wheat in place of the rye, and 14% malted barley aged in the number 3 barrels. The only difference between this and your standard bottle of Maker's Mark is that this is bottled at 101 proof instead of 90.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So I've seen that was 50.5% alcohol.
It's just stronger.
It's stronger, and I think they may do some more stuff to this. I know they said that these spend... they're aged 6 years. They spend the first 3 at the top of the facility and then the next 3 at the bottom. I don't know if they do that for every Maker's Mark bottle or just these.
Yeah.
But Maker's Mark is on my list,
as
we've discussed recently. And we'll see if this is an improvement on the classic.
Put hair on your chest and make it curl.
Yeah.
Very interesting to me. I love rye whiskeys that are mostly rye and they've got that spicier flavor. And I love Maker's Mark, which has no rye.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, Maker's Mark is really one of the sweeter bourbons.
A little homework for myself. I need to find out if any other bourbons use that red winter wheat.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if they do.
I wonder if the red winter wheat helps with the sweetness.
Possibly.
I don't know.
Well, the rye has that peppery, sharp taste to it.
And the...
All right, guys. Let's give it a try.
It's got a great nose.
It does.
Ooh-wee.
It definitely changes the flavor of Maker's Mark.
That will cross your eyes and dot your T's.
I
like it, though. It's got just enough bite to it to make you feel like you got something there.
Yeah.
Without the long-term, like, it's not taking your breath away.
Yeah.
And it's an initial waft of the burn, and then it mellows and it's gone.
Gone. And it's got a caramel tone. This is really nice.
Yeah, it disappears into caramel real quick.
This may be because of what they're doing to these bottles, but the flavor of this is a lot more pronounced than the last bottle of Maker's Mark I had, which was recent.
Yeah.
So, interesting. Yeah. Still one of my top favorites. The 101, if you can find it, is not a lot more than your standard 90 proof bottle. And Maker's Mark's not a cheap bourbon by any means. It's $27 to $30.
Definitely a higher mid-grade.
Yeah. But well worth it, guys. We're gonna enjoy this.
Absolutely, that's great.
And in lieu of deer season, gun season starting up, we're gonna talk about something that's near and dear to the Viking: conservation, hunting, and some of our woods stories. Yes. I grew up in the woods. I think we all did.
Yeah.
Woods adjacent. Yeah.
Woods adjacent. I like the way you put that. Yeah. Yeah. We were within short travel distance.
Yeah.
You grew up, or when I met you anyway, and you'd been there for a while, not too far from the Crosley Shooting Range.
Yes.
As the crow flies, what, maybe half mile?
Yeah. Very close. We were on the T at the end of that road, and yeah, you drive straight down to it. I had a pond back there. That was the most alive pond I've ever seen in my life. It was fed from some kind of, I think, underground stream.
It had to have been to stay that clear in the woods, because it was a woods pond.
Yeah.
Those usually get tannic real bad, and usually within a few years, they lose all the life in them.
Yeah. You could scoop out a solid foot of leaf litter from the bottom, bucking leaf litter, and you would find layers of life in there.
I bet that would make the best garden fertilizer.
Yeah.
Oh, I bet
it
would.
If you pulled a bucket or two of that out and threw it on your garden.
Never seen that many dragonfly larvae anywhere else.
Really?
You would get them every time you scooped a net.
I have a fun fact. They've recently ran the numbers. Mm-hmm. They've done the statistics. The dragonfly is the most efficient hunter on the planet.
I could see that.
The average predatory species on this planet is around 42% success rate.
Uh-huh.
They're at like 82% success rate.
That's insane.
Yeah. They have, the dragonfly is completely adapted to just hunt. They're badasses.
Yeah. I was in Naples, Florida. Some friends of mine built a house. They moved from a condo, built a house right on a golf course.
Yeah.
And standing water on golf courses is going to always be a problem when they do that to the land and swamp land.
Yeah.
They're towards the Everglades. You head that way. And when we were out there, they were talking about mosquito prevention and all this. And there was just swarms of dragonflies. I'm like, they're here to eat the mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That will do it.
Yeah. They're just out there dive bombing.
They're eating the mosquitoes like crazy. And then I guarantee you the bats are coming in just before dark and snatching the mosquitoes and dragonflies. And everybody's happy.
Yeah.
Yep. When the ecosystem's in balance like that, everything benefits.
The only thing really out of balance that I've seen in South Florida that is very obvious to my eye is when I was there, they have two tree frogs now that they've become like buddies with.
Yeah.
These guys are always there. They come back to the same spots. But they're Cuban tree frogs.
Yeah. Oh, really? Florida is riddled with invasive species.
Yes.
Non-resident invasive species. And because of the constrictors that have been turned loose and are like exploding down there.
Thriving.
They've done tests recently and there are 10% or less, sometimes in some areas as little as 0% of mammals 40 pounds and under left in the areas where those constrictors are. That's almost completely wiped them out.
Yeah.
Raccoons, I'm not sure if armadillos are that far south or not, but raccoons, possums, squirrels, anything in that area. I mean, 10% at max.
Yeah.
I mean, they've almost completely wiped out small mammal crazy. Species.
That's why they're doing the open hunts on the snakes.
Yeah. Oh, they're not even open. They're paying people.
Yeah.
Paying people pigs to come and snakes down there.
Yeah.
I considered that. I'm not even kidding. Cause
you can make some
money.
You know what you're doing. You can make some pretty decent money in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
Down there going snake hunting.
So the Cuban tree frog, this is kind of like they're the wildest tree frog I've ever seen. They look like your standard gray tree frog from Indiana.
Yeah.
But they get about the size of a medium bullfrog.
Oh, wow.
They are massive.
That's crazy.
They can secrete kind of a sticky substance.
Yeah.
I know their poop is like a rock.
Really?
It's a problem. People be like, oh, the tree frogs are
crapping in my car.
And they're just so suited to hunt and survive there that the green tree frog, and the green tree frog's a quarter that size.
Yeah.
Frogs work on, oh, I'm going to swallow this thing.
Yeah.
Also,
if it's in my mouth, I'm eating it.
Yeah, so they'll eat the green tree frogs.
They will. They're eating the green tree frogs. They're eating the anoles, which anoles there are almost all also brown anoles, which have out-competed and hybridized with the green anoles.
Yeah.
And the other thing that you'll see around there consistently are the bufo toads.
Yeah.
I've actually posted a picture of one of those guys.
Really?
I have seen some of those that are the size of small cats. Monsters.
Really?
Yes.
I knew they got big. But
I only saw one decent-sized one down there. I got a picture of him. He was about, I don't know, 6-7 inches long. Maybe 4 or 5 inches tall.
Have you seen the size of the, speaking of amphibians, but have you seen the size of the bullfrogs that they pull out of Texas? Like, it's the same green bullfrog we have up here, because their growing season never stops down there. Yeah. They're pulling out like 5-pound bullfrogs down there.
That's wild.
Hunting, it's crazy. For.
Yeah.
It's just those
Louisiana
areas.
Louisiana is the same way.
Louisiana, Florida, most of the parts of Texas and stuff like that. Those areas are so well suited for those type of things to adapt and thrive.
Yeah.
That those are the most dangerous places to turn loose invasive species. Because, man, you're talking about a lot of the places we get our invasive species from are like jungle areas or African plains areas where the predators that they're used to dealing with that they've adapted to deal with are so much bigger or poisonous. So they're coming over here and they're having a heyday.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like there's nothing here that threatens them. Nothing that competes with them, and they just explode.
Very interestingly, I don't remember if anybody remembers this. It was 2000, maybe 5 or 6. There was this giant panic over snakeheads.
Yes.
Bullseye snakehead can walk on land. And
I actually watched a documentary on PBS about the snakehead. Yes,
so the only thing that was even terrifying about snakeheads that would have made sense for them to be that scary is they're anabantoids.
Yeah.
So they can live in muck where there's no
they live in rice paddies a lot.
Yes, they live in rice paddies.
They're a huge problem because they can take a finger.
They're like a catfish.
Yeah,
and they can live outside of water as long as they're moist for hours and hours.
Yeah.
The only legitimate thing that I ever heard about them, and maybe it's unsubstantiated, I don't know, but I heard it and took it as fact, was the only real danger I heard about them was that they burrow into mud and they could damage dams. Put them in freshwater ponds and stuff like that. They'll eventually burrow through enough to where they'll damage the dam over time. They're actually becoming a popular game fish.
They're a killer game fish. They're not nearly as dangerous as they thought
they were.
Supposed
to be amazing to eat.
Yeah.
They're a little hard to clean, but supposed to be amazing, really white fish to eat. And there's a whole society of people now that are just snakehead hunters.
So, interestingly enough, I researched this about how this snakehead panic happened. You can no longer go to a pet store in Indiana and buy a snakehead. Right. I don't care how many snakeheads you let go in Indiana.
Yeah.
They're never establishing here.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't matter that they can breathe. They can't be frozen. They're just not adjusted to that yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, it wouldn't matter at all. But this is a global panic. Well, what they actually found out happened was they're pretty sure that some entrepreneurs realized that there's a culture there that love those. They're a delicacy.
Yeah.
And they just started stocking these golf course ponds with them.
Yeah.
And then Florida floods.
Yeah.
And it pushes them over into the trench, in the ditches and rivers.
Well, that and the people that like them in the... In the conservation world, they call it bucket biology.
Yeah.
But they use it for that term for a lot of different things. But it's literally, in this case, it is bucket biology because, I mean, how many people have we known in our lives that have been like, they'll go to a river or something like that and catch 4 or 5 nice sized bass and put them in a bucket full of water because I'm going to take them home to the farm pond, put them in there, and let them breed. And they'll do the same thing with these snakeheads and stuff like that because they like them.
Yeah,
so they'll take them and take them to a pond next door, throw them in there, and they're just—they're a very fecund race. So I mean, if it's an environment that they're adapted to, they grow well.
Yeah.
Do you remember the Paku fish outbreak, the sheep's head fish?
Yeah.
In Illinois, in particular, a man had his testicles bitten off by one.
Oh!
Yeah.
Paku are like a piranha with human teeth. Yeah. It is the creepiest.
They're terrifying
thing.
Looking. Yeah. They literally have human teeth. They have incisors.
Yeah, most of the sheep's heads have those type of
things.
And they're all vegetarians, so I don't know why that guy, maybe mistook the hair for moss or something, because those teeth are like that because they scrape rocks.
Yeah.
And they scrape the moss off a rock, so maybe he was skinny.
It might just be a wise tale, but it was on the news.
I remember the Paku thing.
Yeah.
I remember hearing about that, and they were more concerned about it.
And you just never can tell for sure, because, I mean, there was that catfish that was being real aggressive for some reason in Hardy Lake here, 3-4 years ago?
Yeah.
It bit like half a dozen people.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just a big channel cat, I think.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was biting and taking little bloody chunks out of people. Nothing, no major harm. But if those bloody chunks had been a little further north,
Yeah,
you could have heard about it.
You could have popped a testicle. I mean,
popped catfish can bite hard.
If you get a 15-pound channel cat lashed onto your sack, you're in trouble.
Your sack's in trouble.
I landed probably a 9-pound channel cat on just a basic spinning reel. Little light, 6-pound test line, monofilament, nothing special at all. So I get him on the bank. I'm all excited, right? And I reach my thumb right into his mouth like a bass. And pick him up, and he does like a crunch, like flips his tail up in the air and bites down on my thumb. And my thumb bled. You could see the little, like a little pad full of little razors. Ridges. Like little,
it's almost like a file.
Yeah. And man, he would not let go for a minute. I was like, oh my God, I was a kid back then. I was still excited to catch
them. They can grab hard. There's people that die every year from noodling for catfish.
Yeah,
because they'll reach below their headline and grab a catfish that holds on and don't want to leave that thing.
Gets itself wedged in the rocks.
I mean, a bunch of them die with their eyes sticking out of the water.
That's so crazy.
Because they just can't get far enough up to get a breath.
My favorite fishing moment from growing up, I fished every summer at my grandpa's farm pond, and there was this legendary bass, a largemouth bass in my grandpa's farm pond we called Tigro. I don't know how he got the name Tigro, but he's like legendary. Generations.
I guess it had something to do with Thundercats.
Yeah, I think Dad might have named him when he was a kid or something. But anyway, I thought for sure I'd caught him because this fish was fighting me. And all I ever caught out of there was smallmouth bass and bluegill. And this fish is fighting so hard. I finally get it reeled in near the bank and I can see it, and it's not a big fish, and it's bending the shit out of my pole. I'm like 9 years old. Dad had to help me get it on shore. Yeah, it was a nice sized bluegill with a bullfrog, had about half of its body in his mouth.
That is insane.
And he was not letting go.
That is awesome. Dad, I just
fight hard when you got him on a fishing line.
Yeah, it was crazy. I hadn't hooked him. He just would not go with that fish for nothing. He's like, oh, my fish.
I mean, that's the damn bluegill. Yeah, absolutely.
And it was bigger than him. He didn't give a shit.
Probably one of my favorite, and we did this a couple times. This is probably my favorite fishing experience when I was a kid growing up. I would go with my dad, and we knew where there was an overflow that was set up. It was man-made for a road. Yeah. And the overflow would run down through this pipe across under the road and dump out. Where it dumped out, it had carved out this deep, almost a little quarry pond, but it was maybe 10 foot deep. I don't even know if it was that deep.
Was it over at Brush Creek Reservoir?
No, it's towards Seymour.
Okay. There was a similar one that I used to fish by Brush Creek.
Yes. So this thing was, it's the size of like a kiddie pool. It was small.
Yeah.
You couldn't jump across. It was a little too wide for that, but you could walk down a few feet and walk right over the stream and get on either side of it.
Yeah.
So we would go down there and you could see the fish. I mean, you could drop a bear hook in there and get a bite of a small bluegill or something, but
they were starved.
There were huge carp in there. Dad called them buffalo. Yeah. They're a type of local carp. And Dad caught one of those finally. I mean, monster. Probably 15 pounds.
Yeah.
Which is huge when you're dealing with a little puddle.
Yeah.
But I pulled a fish out of there that I'd never seen in my life. And I swear they have glowing eyes. They have teeth. And they look like a snakehead. They look just like a snakehead. They call them dogfish.
But
They're both fins.
Dogfish. Both fins. Yeah.
Yeah. And they get big. I had a big one, Bucket Biology. We had it in a bucket at the house because Dad was like, I've never seen one of these local to here. He'd seen sauger. Yeah. He's like, it looks like a weird sauger.
Yeah, like an eel and a sauger had a kid.
Yes, and we could see these fish, and finally we caught one, and I was like, man, what is this? So, we figured it out, and they're not all that uncommon, but that's the only time I've ever caught one.
And they're more prominent the further south you go.
Yeah.
Dogfish are. Indiana's probably the furthest north you'll see them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of, we're in this, like, weird transition place.
We are,
there's pockets of walleye and sauger, whatever you want to call them. Sauguys, sometimes they'll hybrid. I'm pretty sure this area of the Ohio has got a lot of sauguy in it. We got like a little bit of both worlds around here.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll never have grayling or anything that live in like super cold water. Indiana's got trout.
Yeah.
Indiana's got anywhere from trout down to dogfish little both ends.
Yep. There's a dam right out here by the Urban Training Center that I'd love to go fish at. You won't catch anything serious. You might catch a big catfish now and again.
Yeah.
But you can pull up the most insanely colored sunfish I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
They are crazy out of there. I don't know if it's the water. if it's the way that dam overflowing is, maybe that's like a spawning ground for them.
Maybe.
So they get real colorful. But, I mean, you could probably go do that.
Oh, their teeth are intimidating.
Oh, yes.
I'm looking at the bowfin. Check out the grill.
Oh, yeah. I would not stick my finger in their teeth. Mouth.
Yeah. Those are testicle getters.
do yourselves a favor. Google bowfins. And if you're feeling extra frisky, say testicle getter. You might find a new fetish.
You might. So, you know, we're talking about this, guys, and a lot of what when we do fishing and things like this, we do it because we enjoy it. But there's also the aspect of we're fascinated with what's here. I'm fascinated with the invasive species and things like this and what actually happens. And I think everybody that's deeply involved, genuinely involved in hunting and fishing, things like this, is at heart a conservationist, and they love nature.
Yeah.
Almost everyone.
And that's something that I've always found fascinating, is that strange dichotomy of a certain group of people being so opposed to hunting, and without hunting, we wouldn't have deer in this state.
We wouldn't.
Like, in the 50s and 60s, we didn't have deer in this state. Like,
well, I remember the reduction hunt in Monroe County and how controversial that was.
Yeah.
Oh, remember big time. That one? Big time. Yeah,
because the deer were literally dying.
Of starvation.
And they had stripped off all the leaves.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were, not only were they dying of starvation, but they were causing massive devastation to the plant life in the area, which was causing starvation for everything else that lived there.
Yep.
It was just destroying a huge, massive problem. But the people don't, the anti-hunters, I mean, I get the sentiment. I get that you don't like death.
You don't like cruelty.
And it's not cruelty, but I can promise you this, that there is not a single wild animal left without a human hunter going after it that dies as gentle a death.
Yep.
As a human hunter will give it.
Yeah.
An animal left in the wild never dies of old age. It will die of starvation. It will die of injury. It will die of predation by other predators in the wild, which kill them so much more horrifically than a human bullet or arrow can do. Or they die of disease.
Yep. Yeah.
And every one of those is
a slower,
so much more horrific and painful and traumatizing than anything a human can do.
Most great apes, when left to their own, die what's called dental death. Yeah. They'll literally get an infected tooth that kills them.
That was actually the number one cause of death for you know, what we consider Native Americans.
Yeah.
After all the bone records and stuff like that that we pulled up, most of them died of heart attacks, most likely, but because of dental infections.
Yep.
Yeah. Because they were still Stone Age, and everything that they ate had stone dust in it and would wear their teeth down early.
I actually read a really interesting article last year that there was a huge study done on Neanderthal, and they think the one advantage that we had over them is we have these small tubes in our ears that as we age break and slant so that our ears can drain. Theirs didn't break. Every adult Neanderthal they've ever found still has straight tubes. So every Neanderthal they found, they assume had an ear infection.
That's amazing.
And that is a huge disadvantage in the wild. You're a hunter. Think about how much you use your hearing.
Oh, big time.
That's a huge disadvantage. And you're miserable and in pain.
Oh, yeah. Well, and more than anything, it doesn't even kill you from starvation because, you know, group hunters and group societies, which we always have been, all humanoids have been, the younger will take care of the older.
Yeah.
But the problem is any long-term infection weakens the heart. So eventually you'll just have a heart attack if you've got a sustained infection for a long period of time.
I've actually known some people who died from dental infections. One of them was a brain aneurysm. A clot in the brain.
Yeah.
Not an aneurysm, infection. That would be a
stroke. But the same thing. And it's amazing. It's amazing how much we've realized that how much of what we call modern humans are hybrids between one type of human and Neanderthals.
Ella, for the longest time, had 90-something% more Neanderthal DNA than everyone that had done 23andMe.
Yeah.
Yeah, it slowly went down as more people tested and they started finding it more and more.
If you don't aren't directly from sub-Saharan Africa, because Neanderthal never crossed the Sahara.
Right.
But if you're not from a very small place on the planet, essentially, you're at least 1% Neanderthal.
Yeah.
And you see people that you know. That percentage is a little higher.
Showing.
They got the 5 head that sticks out 2 inches over their brow. Yeah.
Are we allowed to mention celebrities?
Yeah.
I mean, we're not getting paid for this. I imagine it would matter. Joe Rogan. had his test and he's got like high amounts of that would fit. Yeah. You can see it all over his face.
Yes, you can.
But Steve Ranilla, I don't know if you knew who he is or not. He's the owner of Meat Eater, the host of Meat Eater, the show. He had his test and he's got like little to none, and he's so disappointed about it.
He's upset.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's funny.
That's hilarious. That does not surprise me about Rogan, though.
It does not.
No, he looks like a caveman.
He's very ape-like.
Yeah, booga booga. But yeah, it's
interesting.
I love just the discovery of nature, and even if it's something that I've seen 100 times, it can still surprise you.
Yeah.
And sometimes you'll see something that happens that's out of the blue and that never happens again. You don't know why. I remember one time I was deer hunting and I was early 20s, maybe late teens, early 20s.
Right.
And at this point, I'd been deer hunting since I was 12.
Yeah.
I've been deer hunting on my own. Well, technically, I was on my own when I killed my first deer. I just wasn't far from other people. They dropped me off and went home. But yeah. I've been deer hunting on my own since I was about 15. Yeah. So for several years. And I've been hunting with my dad since I was 6 or 7. I mean, I've been in the woods all my life. Literally all my life.
Yeah.
And I had never seen this before or since. But I was sitting in a deer stand right behind my old house over here.
Yeah.
And it's a strip of woods that's probably 150 yards wide between two fields.
Oh, wow.
And just before dark, I'd say probably about the last half an hour to 45 minutes of daylight where you can see real well, I started hearing something. Of course, when you're that young and inexperienced, any movement in the leaves is a deer coming. So my heart's just thump, 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 and I'm all getting ready. And I look over and here comes a raccoon.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm disappointed.
Yeah.
And then I hear another one just seconds later. Oh, that one's got to be a deer.
Uh-huh.
No, it's another raccoon. And it just kept happening. And all together, I counted 16 raccoons.
What?
That came from 5 different directions and all met in a semicircle around 1 shagbark hickory. And they all just stood around and hung around the bottom of this hickory tree.
You witnessed their annual meeting.
It was the craziest thing. Teens, 16, I counted. And I don't know how many. I mean, it was getting close to dark by the time they all got there together.
Yeah. Right.
And then they just kind of converged around the bottom of this enormous, like it would take 2 of me, and I'm 6'4", to get my arms around the thing. Huge shagbark hickory. And this, in a semicircle around this, all these coons just got together and hung out for 3 or 4 minutes, like they were just meeting up to pass the day's news before they went out to their jobs, and then just separated and went their own separate ways again.
That was a water cooler moment.
I've never seen that before. Since teens of raccoons came from 5 different directions in this woods, from the field, from my left, from my right, across from the other field, 5 different directions, 16 coons that I counted for sure, came together.
Yeah.
Underneath this tree, converged for about 3 minutes, and then separated and went their own way.
It's crazy.
No interaction other than that?
They just kind of hung out. I mean, they were sniffing on each other and doing whatever because they were 80 yards away from me. The tree was that they converged on, and it was starting to fail in light, but you could see them all over there, and they were right next to each other. I mean, right next to each other, like a kennel full of puppies.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
And then just turned and left. Like they were exchanging news of the day before they went about their business of the night.
Yeah, clearly. They have a daily meeting.
Yeah.
It's funny because there are, it's so weird. You'll see things in nature that only happen one place. Like a great example, I finally got to see it 3 years ago. Last time I was down in Tennessee in the Smokies. If you go down there at the beginning of spring to summer or the end of summer, you can catch it. There's one valley, and I cannot remember the name of the valley. I believe it's just south of Cades Cove is where we were. But all of the lightning bugs meet in this one valley in blank in unison.
Yep.
And they say that's the only place on the world that it's been recorded. They know that it probably happens elsewhere, but that is the only place we know for a fact that... And they average in the millions.
Right.
They all meet, and they do it at the beginning of the season and at the end.
Well, that might be 1 of 12 places or so, but it definitely doesn't happen every place.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen in my pasture every year.
No, yeah, it doesn't happen. By the golf course by Selmayr.
Right. When we saw it, because that was one of our goals while we were down there, because we were down there perfect time of year. We were down at the end. And it's right around the fall solstice that the last time they do it. And we were like, we're going to miss it. We're going to miss it. We're all frantically trying to get out, find this valley to right. see it. And if I didn't believe in fairies before, I would have by the end of that night. Because it's hard not to believe in magic when you see something
like that. Something that
you see several million lightning bugs all just blinking in unison, and it was so peaceful. And I realized there was not... It, like, silenced the forest for a moment.
Uh-huh.
Like it was like the forest was giving them reverence or something. Like, you didn't hear birds calling and squirrels moving around. Like, everything just
It's like everything stopped to watch.
For just something so beautiful happened.
Yeah, just to see it.
And you don't know why. Maybe it's something simple. I've thought about that raccoon thing before, because I have noticed a lot of times you'll find, like, one log in the woods that is just covered in raccoon crap.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
Might have been their toilet tree.
most things in the woods, especially predators, most predators in the wild have... They mark areas.
Yeah.
Even prey will do... A white-tailed deer, a buck, will make a scrape for about 2 months of the year.
Yeah.
And he'll keep a scrape active because that's his territory and that's how he's marking it and keeping it fresh. And I thought maybe that was just a place that they went to every day to kind of mark, like the mailbox at the end of the road that everybody that walks their dog pees on.
Yeah.
And maybe it just happened to be that day they all got there at the same time. But how many people have been lucky enough to sit in the woods when all the raccoons decide to go to the marking tree at the same time?
It's like something out of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
I'm not even kidding. I mean, it really stuff like this really happens. Like,
yeah.
Wow, it's wild.
I think anyone who's spent a large amount of time in the woods, there comes this moment after hours and hours or even days in the woods that you start to feel like you're part of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the animals stop worrying about you.
Yeah.
And you kind of get like a behind the scenes look at nature. I mean, you've told me many stories of deer just walking up to you.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Like, the turkeys especially. Turkeys will, I will talk to turkeys. So I'll be out fishing and hear turkeys calling. I've got a really good, really good natural voice call, and I'll just start talking to them, and they'll come down the hill and just stand there 50 yards away and cluck at me and
they're
look,
like,
and then eventually they'll be like, oh, okay,
they're like,
not
is that
turkey.
A chick? Is that a chick? Yeah. Can we get in there?
But I'll call hens in.
She's really tall.
Got a long hair. I don't remember
but
turkeys
having
hair.
But she's saying the right shit, man. She's talking.
She's got a good voice. But I'll call gobblers in, but I'll call hens in, too.
Yeah.
I don't know how many deer I've killed, and I've noticed this for over most of my deer hunting career. It's kind of came on, slowly before it kind of dawned on me, but... Turkeys have an incredible sense of hearing, an incredible sense of sight, and they can actually see color.
Yeah.
There's one of the few things in the woods that you actually, like, they sell a lot of camo for deer hunters and stuff like that. You can wear it solid brown and kill a deer.
Yeah.
I mean,
you can wear plaid.
As long as you don't move, deer are not going to see you much.
Yeah.
A turkey, on the other hand, is a completely different story. They can see color and they find detail on it. A deer, I don't know if it's a recent adaptation or if it's just something they've always done, but I could not tell you, I mean, dozens and dozens and dozens of times I've seen a turkey come in and will be immediately followed by a deer, and they will hang out together.
Really?
Like a turkey's relying on the deer's nose,
and
a deer's relying on the turkey's eyes, and they both have amazing senses of hearing.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they will come in together, and I don't know how many times I've killed a deer because I'll hear a lost hen. Like, when a hen gets separated from its flock, especially in the fall, they'll make a lot of noise, a lot of yuck, 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 yuck. And I'll start calling back to them. As soon as you start calling back to them, they start getting quieter and just talking back and forth to you. And then when they get close, I stop making any noise, and the turkey will come in looking, and within a minute, there'll be a deer coming in behind that turkey. Now, I'm not saying it happens every time, but I'd say 50%. 40%?
Yeah.
There's a deer walking through because it don't know why that turkey's making all that noise. It's just walking along with the turkey.
Yeah. I had an interesting moment the other day. I just went back into my little back field. It's half an acre of, I call it the small woods. It's recent woods. Like, I let it
Young growth, new growth.
Yeah. I let it go to seed 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so... I was just walking back there, kind of surveying. I was actually looking at where the deer are bedding down back there. And I made eye contact with a coyote. It's the closest I've ever been to a coyote. Whoa. He was just hanging out. He was alone. I waited. I just stood there staring him down, holding my ground. He wasn't big. Coyotes, everyone that's never been close to a coyote right. always talks about how huge and aggressive.
No, they're not that big.
They're about 35 or 40 pounds.
Yeah. My dogs could take a coyote, no problem. Yeah. Now, 15 of them, that'd
that's
be a problem. Exactly.
Yeah, that's usually when your dogs are in danger. Yeah.
But I never saw another one, and I was scanning, and I had gone down there with I don't know why here lately when I hike, I bring my grandpa's old binoculars.
It's awesome.
It is. I'd never thought about it in the past. I've been hiking my whole life, and all of a sudden, I got sick of not being able to see shit that I know I'll see.
So I just take them with me.
I zoomed him in, and he was only 15 yards away from me, but I got a clear look at him. He walked out into one of the deer beds I was looking at. I put the binoculars on him, and we were staring each other down. He was alone, though. And it's beautiful. Their eyes are really impressive.
They are. And that yellow gold.
Yeah, his eyes look like they were, like, glowing in the evening long.
You're talking about the coyotes not being as big as people think they are. Wolves are the same way. Yeah. People are stupid. I mean, wolves have got this, like, almost mythical presence in people's mind, and I don't understand why. Like, everybody was big on, because we released them into the Yellowstone area, but they're now in like 75% of the western states. We got them in Michigan again. I mean, they were finally the last president delisted them in 2020. Finally delisted them after so long, because they were one of the very first ones on the endangered species list before we knew what we were doing. And we put in parameters for their delisting, but we didn't word it quite right. And because we didn't word it quite right, it allowed a foothold for the anti-hunters to come in and do lawsuits to just keep pushing back. Anyway, so we finally got, like, almost every state that we released them in is like fivefold more than wolves than the parameters were for delisting them. And even at that, they were only ever extirpated from those areas. They've never been in danger of extinction. They killed them out of helicopters in Canada to keep their numbers down, because there's so freaking many of them. We weren't in danger of losing wolves. But everybody wants to picture, like, the wolves on Twilight or something. These big 400-pound wolves. The average wolf we have in America is like 80 pounds.
And timber wolves especially, they're not...
Timber wolves are small. They're like 60.
They're like 50, 60 pounds.
But the gray wolf, the one that everybody's used to seeing and stuff like that, which, by the way, most of the ones you see on TV are actually Salukis. But they're a dog, not a wolf. But the gray wolf averages about 80 pounds. Like one that reaches 100 pounds is monstrous in size.
And it's funny because as far as height goes, the dire wolves, we always think dire wolves had to have been giant. They weren't any taller or longer. They had denser bones.
They were heavier bones and bigger jaws.
They're 150 pounds as opposed to 80.
They were almost twice what a gray wolf is, which, just, I mean, is big enough. Because, I mean, people in history have gotten killed. I mean, what was it? Was it World War One? I think that they had to stop. We were fighting the Russians, and we had to stop mid-battle because the wolves were starved. They had such a bad winter that winter that the wolves were starving, and they had started coming down and picking people off in camps. We had to make a temporary truce and come together, troops shoulder to shoulder with people they were trying to kill a few days ago, to go out and hunt and kill these wolves before they could start fighting again. Because these wolves were coming down in droves out of the mountains in Russia and killing people so bad.
Russia's so hardcore.
One of my fascinations is Romania. Because Romania is set between essentially the East and the West. Since its beginnings, and especially County Wallachia,
wasn't for the vampires.
Where is actually where Vlad Dracul lived? He was the governor of Wallachia. They had such a wolf problem when the Ottomans. It kept on changing hands between the Catholics and the Ottomans. Catholics, Ottomans, and like literally several times a year, it would change hands. It was a war zone for a couple hundred years, and out of nowhere, they don't know what caused it, if it was just a particularly harsh winter or something. This pack of wolves in Romania, they're called a black wolf. The several people on both sides of the conflict wrote about this pack that numbered in the hundreds, and it ended the fighting.
Yeah,
because they had to start fighting the wolves.
Yeah, you gotta call a truce to kill the wolves. Yeah, they're just picking us off while we're facing each other.
It was literally like an entire year that the war essentially ended because they had to fight this giant pack of wolves. Yeah. And I'm sure through history and stuff, it's been embellished. But there were several generals on both sides that wrote about numbering in the hundreds. They couldn't get an exact count, but they stopped counting in the hundreds.
You got to wonder if the pressure of that, the war zone stuff, doesn't make super packing.
Yeah.
Oh, it does.
Forces them together, and then they're social animals.
That would make sense.
Well, and it's not just that, though. It's like a perfect storm. Mm-hmm. Like the one, I don't know as much about that one. I've heard about it, but I've read a lot about the one in World War One, and it was because it was a battle that we'd been in for a while.
Yeah.
We were entrenched. And so there was a lot of blood and stuff like that in there, which will always attract some wolves.
Yeah.
And normally you would get like one or two packs, so you're talking like 20 to 25 wolves coming in there, which is not a big deal for anybody to deal with, especially two armies.
Yeah.
But the problem was you're in the mountains in a particularly harsh winter back in the 19-teens.
Yeah,
when winters were harsh anyway.
Yeah.
So we had all these wolves coming further south because
they were pushed south. And their food sources are already stressed.
They're already starving because of the winter. And they're pushed south because of the winter. Not south. They're pushed down from the mountains. They're pushed down off the
lower elevation.
Yeah. So down, and they ended up with all these different packs that were coming together because of the starvation up north, up in the higher elevations, they were getting pushed down, and they happened to be fighting in the trenches down in the valleys of these mountains. So you get like 15 or 20 different wolf packs coming together, and then suddenly they went from starving to here's a buffet. And they, I mean, they didn't fight amongst themselves because there was so much to choose from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The number one killer of wolves worldwide is wolves.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Know that.
In fact, it reminds me, I've started this off about the kind of ridiculousness of our of trying to bring them back in the lower 48 when they weren't in danger. I get it to an extent, but it got out of hand. All the way up to the point that I'm coming to, there was a, I want to say it was Michigan controlled.
Yeah.
But I cannot remember for sure who actually owned the island. But there's an island in one of the Great Lakes up there. I don't remember if it's Michigan or what's the other one that touches Erie. Is it Michigan? Is it Erie?
It's Erie.
Yeah. It's one of those two Great Lakes. One of the Great Lakes.
Three of them. Yeah.
There's a pretty good sized island out there.
Yeah.
And who knows how many years ago, during one of the freezes, animals came across onto this. They actually discovered through not fossil, but going over there and finding bones and stuff like that, that originally this island was almost exclusively caribou and lynx.
Really?
And then the problem was that this island, as it turns out, has been cyclical for a very long period of time. It'll freeze hard enough to create essentially a land bridge.
Yeah.
And further north, it gets so bad cold that everything's starting to starve and they try to move south. Well, they move across this ice that they don't understand.
And they can't go back.
And then they find vegetation that's on this island. They stay there long enough, then the melt happens, and then it doesn't freeze again for 50 years.
Yeah.
Or whatever. So originally, this island was all caribou and lynx. And so they had only one predator and only one prey. So it was like a perfect ecosystem there for the longest period of time. Well, then it slowly over time, when there wasn't enough of the land bridge or the ice bridge to add anything new, well, genetics eventually wash out because, you know, when you start out with 20 caribou, there can only be so much genetic distinction, in the same way with the lynx. And it slowly washes out, and then they all died. That was long before we had anything to do with the area. Most recently, and we estimated it was somewhere near like 100 to 150 years ago, it froze enough to where most recently it's wolves and moose.
Really?
Yeah. Well, the problem with that is the moose, once it's not a calf anymore, is entirely too big for most packs of wolves.
Yes, they will kill anything. Yeah.
So we discovered it.
People don't realize how giant a full-grown wolf is.
And how aggressive a moose is. Well, anyway, during our mania of bringing wolves back to anywhere they kind of used to be, they decided that this wolf pack that was on this island, they wanted to preserve it. Even though it was completely planted.
Yeah,
naturally planted, but it was never there to begin with. We even have bone records to prove it. But they decided they were going to try to save them.
Right.
There was so many moose on this freaking island that, like, the vegetation's starting to wane. But it had gotten so bad with the genetic isolation that there were two wolves left, and they were both kind of genetically fucked up.
two wolves
completely. And I remember hearing the stories about whether, you know, they were talking about whether they should or whether they shouldn't. They finally decided they should. So I think they released somewhere in the neighborhood of like 12 to 15 wolves. I can't remember. A handful of wolves on here to reestablish a pack. The first thing that those new wolves did was kill the old wolves. The two that were there that they were trying to preserve, the natural ones that were there, the very first, like within a week, they killed the two wolves.
These hills have eyes, motherfuckers need to go.
Yeah. Well, if you've ever, I mean, I'm sure you guys have probably had this. I have a 5-dog pack now. I've had up to an 8-dog pack.
Yeah.
And as soon as you get 3 dogs, pack dynamic appears. I don't care how great you think Fufu is.
Yeah.
Put him in a room with 2 other dogs and watch shit change.
Yeah.
They start speaking a different language. Order. It's insane.
Yeah.
And if you've never broken up a dog fight of like 4 or 5 of them, you don't understand at all. Like, it is...
It doesn't matter the breed.
It doesn't matter about that your little poodle is so kind.
It
cocker
will rip your face off if it thinks its territory is
being threatened. You're going to get fingers hurt and stuff at the minimum.
Well, I'll never forget this one. It was actually our very goofy, young girl rat terrier jumped off the bed and completely biffed it and hit the door frame and started just screaming and yelping. So Tula runs up to her and starts sniffing her, like, oh my God, what happened? Smokey thinks, oh, well, Tula must have done something, and bites Tula in the butt.
Yeah.
Tula's our corgi.
Right.
Yeah. And she was young at the time, maybe 5.
Yeah.
And so, no big deal, right?
Yeah.
This is like a month later. Ella looks at her and says she can just see that Tula's up to something. She said Tula slunk down like a cat. He came over and just dive-bombed Smokey. Death fight. Death fight. It was like she held on to that whole time for revenge.
Yeah. Corgis are weird, though.
They're savage dogs.
Too much intelligence for their going.
They are, and they're assholes. They'll be like...
Yeah, they're vengeful.
So vengeful. So later on, you know, everything seemed to work out fine, and I think we were playing fetch or something in the hallway there. And again, she just decided that he'd slighted her. Death fight again. And when I say death fight, I'm talking blood everywhere. Yeah. So I split them up, and I'd gotten so good at this because they're not. Like, my corgi was fat, but she wasn't big. 25 pounds.
Yeah,
Smokey's tiny. He's 17 pounds, maybe.
Yeah.
And I break him up, and I'm all pissed off. Put him in the kennel, and I'm like, who's bleeding? I'm walking up and down the hallway, and I keep walking back. And there's more and more blood, and I'm like, yell at Ella. I'm like, who's bleeding? And I look down, and my entire index fingernail is completely gone. And I go, oh, my God. It kind of a shock hits me. Yeah, and it was, like, dripping actively. Yeah. Yeah. And I look down because I'm like, oh, my gosh. And my whole fingernail, including the cuticle, complete is laying there.
That's insane.
I didn't feel it happen, but I mean, that was just, that's one of the examples.
Kicks in.
One of the dogs tried to fight through the kennel and got her head caught. Between the kennel and the door. So she thought she's dying.
Yeah.
So Ella's in there, you know, getting the other dog off, trying to help her. Bites her arm as hard as she can. Because this dog thinks she's dying.
Yeah.
She's getting choked to death by her own kennel, but thinks it's us and the other dogs doing it.
Yeah.
Calm down after we got them apart. But yeah, you have to see that one good time. And if it doesn't change your perception, nothing will. Now, it's also amazing. I will bring in people's dogs that are completely out of control.
Yeah.
Because they think they run the show. Yep. And these little tiny assholes will have them in line in no time.
Yeah.
And they don't, normally there's no fights.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just this weird posturing and
gotta establish the order.
Yeah.
You can do that yourself too. I've been training dogs since I was 12.
Yeah.
And I absolutely do not put up with any fighting behavior. I don't care if it's towards me or towards another dog.
Yep.
I do not put up with it. I could not tell you the last time my dogs that I've owned, and I've always owned at least 2.
Yep.
I couldn't tell you the last time that I've had my dogs get in a fight.
Yeah.
I won't put up with it. As soon as I see my dog's hackles raised when they're sniffing another dog, I check it.
Yep.
In puppy behavior, when I see any kind of dominance and everybody wants to talk about, ho, 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 the dogs are humping each other and they're both males, they must be homosexuals. That's so freaking rare.
Yeah, the females will hump.
It's a dominance thing. And when they will do it to people too.
Yep.
But And originally, I started out only doing this whenever they tried to do it to me. Now I do it when I see it do it to me or any other dog, because I don't put up with that. I'm the alpha no matter what. Yep. And they don't need to fight for pecking order. I'm the alpha. That's what matters. Yeah. But anytime they try to do that, that's trying to establish dominance.
They're trying to roll up the chain.
Or when they stand up and try to put a paw on your head or something like that, that's all dominance. It's subtle, but it's a dominance behavior. I don't put it up with it. And when they do the aggressive, like the humping or the biting too hard, anything like that, I hold them down on their back with my fingers across their neck, and I hold them there until they submit. Yeah. Once they submit, I mean, it's not doing them any damage. They might squall like you're setting them on fire, but it's not doing them any damage.
They really will.
But you hold them there until they completely submit.
Yeah.
Well, the ones that have
I do that from a very young age on, and I don't generally have any trouble. Yeah. Unless, now granted, if a dog comes up and gets on my dog, that's a different story, and I don't make my dog stop.
Right.
Yeah. If, you know, there's a difference between starting a fight and finishing a fight.
Well, they got to think that, you know, you're going to be there to back them up too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is what we end up with here. You get a pack of five.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's kind of strange. You know, the fight will break out, but it's weird how they pick sides.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot of fights. These are all adopted dogs. So.
Right, yeah.
Of the things I learned growing up, we always had ferrets. We had up to five at one time, but usually we had three. And the females, even fixed, are, if there's a male around, they are so territorial over that male, they will kill each other. It is nuts. Like,
really?
We had an albino female named Fiona, and we got this new one. Mom was always rescuing animals, and she rescued some grandparents that she knew had bought it for their grandkid, and it bit him. Because it's a ferret, and that's what ferrets do.
They do. Well, they have little needle teeth.
Yeah,
and they like to taste
threw
things.
It in a cage in a back room and just fed it. Never interacted with it. So she's all shy and bashful. And we let her out and let her sniff around. She was already fixed. Fiona was fixed. Fiona was albino, and she damn near killed this new ferret.
Yeah.
Like, damn near, had her by the throat, shaking her by the time we got them apart. And it's hard to get them apart.
Yeah.
Once a ferret latches on, it's hard. We're flicking her in the head.
They got little cat teeth. And they got strong jaws.
And ferrets they're a type of weasel.
They're a mustelid.
Mustelid, which is the same family as the weasel.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure the sexual dimorphism in that particular branch goes towards the female. The females are generally bigger, and they usually rule the roost.
The females were always smaller.
Are they?
Yeah, they're just more aggressive. Far more aggressive.
Yep.
The male, once he got his nuts chopped, he was a stink. We had him for 8 years.
His name was Stink?
Yeah.
Excellent.
And he got so fat and lazy. We literally, my grandpa grandpa built us an A-frame, about 5 foot long cage for him. Half of it was chicken wire and half of it was boxed in. So they could like be indoors in one half and then outdoors the other.
Yeah.
Well, we hung baskets on both sides from the apex of the triangle. And they like to nest, like rats. You put rags and stuff in there. And he would literally, he's got like a gerbil feeder and a water bottle hanging from the chicken wire. He would stretch, and he was about 3 inches short of hitting the wall. He would, and instead of getting out of the basket, he would stretch with everything he had trying to get a drink off the wall. He'd fall out of the basket every fucking time because he's about 2 inches short. He never figured out that he just was never gonna reach it. He's 10 inches and it's like 12 to 14 away. Yeah,
that's the kind of optimism I need in my life.
But every time the basket would swing out from under him once he had enough weight out of it, and he'd flop down and look at me like it's my fault because I'm laughing. He's like, fuck you, dude.
What'd you do that for, man?
I'm like, why don't you just get up and get a drink, dude? He's this big around by the way. Big fat.
You see how much work this takes?
Excellent.
He's the only ferret I've ever seen, and it was a learned behavior over time. Mm-hmm. That would sleep on his back, just completely.
Because he's so
arms
fat.
just wide open, legs spread, like snoring. Fat bastard, see his little belly raising up. Mm-hmm. It was hilarious. And he did snore by then. He was so
I bet.
Chunky.
Well, you got something that's supposed to be a pound and a half, and it's 6 pounds.
Yeah.
It's bigger than a fox squirrel.
Yeah.
Clint, you mentioned earlier that, you know, you hold a dog down like that and stare at them, and they will make, sometimes they'll lose it. I had that happen. I had one of the rescues we got in, same thing.
Yeah.
Wanted to get in your face, all up on you, all the time. So finally, it was just playing and flipped them over.
Yeah.
Seemed cool with it for like 1 second. And then it was like screaming, the full effect show. Not even hurt. No, there's no way you're injuring this dog. No way you're hurting it. And I was like, that. Anyone else sees? Oh my gosh! Like, yeah. It's an act. And finally he finally chilled.
The whole
completely
body
chilled and was like, we're cool.
And they always tuck their chin, give you the I'm in trouble.
Yeah. Well, and the tail goes from tuck to relax.
Yeah.
That's the biggest cue you can get from it. Their whole body can relax, but if that tail's still tucked, they're still in panic mode.
Yeah,
wait for that tail to lay down.
Yep.
Go ahead, sorry.
Yep. No, just thinking about that, I remember that dog doing that and just losing his mind, just screaming. I was like, are you serious? What is your deal? But again, had a lot of problems. It was the kind of dog that you couldn't, if you stared at him long enough, he'd want to get in your face. Like, no.
Well, and one of the problems with the average Joe that really doesn't know anything about dog behavior, most of those people, a lot of women, and I'm not saying this derogatorily, they want them because they're small and cute.
Yeah.
The problem with that is simply because most of those small, cute breeds were bred specifically for being very vicious towards other small things.
Yeah,
they're all terrier derivatives.
Yeah, they're all rat hunters. And
so they're bred to be very high energy and very aggressive.
Yeah,
and even after they've been Americanized, which America does some horrific things to dog breeds.
They do.
But after they've been Americanized, you can only put that much bloodline into something for 150 years. You can't breed that out in 40.
No, it shows back up.
Yeah. Yeah. So you end up with a lot of these small dogs that are fighting towards other dogs, or they're constantly wanting to attack cats or something. Yeah. And it's the wrong type of breed, even though it's the cute one that fits in your purse. Yeah. I get it. It's cute and they love you and it's great. But then you have all these problems outside of that particular dichotomy there.
Yeah.
And it's just the breed. People really need to do the research before they do it. Don't buy it just because it's cute and cuddly and you think it's just going to be the neatest thing for you to stick in your lap or put in your purse
Cocker
or whatever.
Cocker Spaniels tend to have that fear aggression disorder.
Yeah.
My sister had one with that. Terrifying. They'll bite you right in the face.
Yeah.
I had I was engaged 100 years ago, and that girl had this rescue dog that had a face only a mother could love. It was a Scotty mix of some sort. Had this wiry mess of hair, but it was like in patches.
Yeah.
He was
less cute, more hobo.
I've never had a dog dislike me. He would love on me, but if I got near her, if I was alone, he was fine.
Yeah.
But he would literally bite me. And I hated him by the end of it because he made me bleed several times.
Oh, yeah.
He got diagnosed with schizophrenia. Have you ever heard of this?
I have heard of this.
A dog getting diagnosed with fucking schizophrenia? I had no idea it was.
Well, schizophrenia is a vessel disorder in the brain. That's probably what that fear aggression is, where when you're under arrest, what's supposed to happen is your brain's supposed to slow down and push blood to the frontal cortex.
Yeah.
With schizophrenia, those vessels are small. They call it small vessel disorder, and it will pull it away.
Yeah. It'll drain it.
And a lot of that stuff is just from bad breeding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You get over into the European area where most of these dog breeds were created. They were very strict on what could and couldn't breed, and even to the point where most of the time, if they weren't breeding quality, they got put down.
And
you get over here, and once again, I get it. You don't want, death is a nasty thing. Especially when it's something that you give a name to. But the problem comes from allowing whatever to do whatever.
Yeah.
And then you end up with stuff like that.
Yeah.
Say in Germany 50 years ago, if a German wire-haired pointer, for instance, because that's what I'm more familiar with, if they didn't pass a German wire-haired pointer, which is called a Drahthaar over there, which translates to wire hair. Yeah. If it didn't pass the natural ability test by the time it was 2 years old, it was not papered. It was not allowed to be papered, and it was not allowed to be bred.
Yeah.
You had to either put it down or get it fixed.
Yeah.
It just wasn't allowed. And you would end up with same situations like that if it was kept to the same standards. The dogs, you could put two perfect dogs together and they have 8 puppies. 6 of them turn out to be great puppies. 2 of them are going to not.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just the way it's going to work out. And they controlled it so well back then that you didn't have as many of these problems. You didn't have schizophrenia because the dog that was acting like that didn't get to breed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, okay, I'm not saying it never happened, but the chances of it happening were a lot slimmer because they didn't allow those to breed.
Well, this is the big thing I have against people getting what they call pit bulls, which are not. The American Pit Bull Terrier has been gone since they started initially banning sport dog fighting, things like that, rat pitting, all that stuff. It's been gone.
Yeah.
The American Pit Bull Terrier was actually a relatively small terrier looking dog.
Yeah.
Yes. And what's happened is they brought over
McKenzie.
Yes.
He was an actual.
He was a bull terrier. Yes.
Yeah.
That's very simple. That's a.
We created the American Pit Bull Terrier from the
bull terrier. They're supposed to be like 40 pounds.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not
originally created not the to be big, a cattle dog.
They're not the big box headed bully.
That is an
American bully.
This is a scary thing. The dogs that people have mixed together to get those are a Dogo Argentina and the Corsos, the Cane Corsos.
Yeah.
Cane Corsos, I have seen more of those dogs that need to be put down than any other dog ever. And I will say that on this podcast because I've seen it. I've seen four of them.
Yeah,
really. And I've only seen, 10 Cane Corsos in my life. That's crazy.
The only 40%. Dog I've ever seen that I could say equals to that is the Chow.
Yeah.
Yep. Chows and Dalmatians are the other two. I've seen ones that were really bad.
I had a moment delivering pizzas a few years ago out in Squire. I used to keep a bad pizza in the car to feed dogs.
Right.
I was getting out. It's 10 o'clock at night. It's pitch black. There's no street lights near this trailer. It was actually a camper I'm delivering to, which is never good. I'm going in dark.
Camper. Like, no lights. They didn't have electric.
So I leave my headlights on so I can see. And I heard something, and I knew it had to be a dog. So I reach in and grab a piece of pizza because I'm going to just toss it if it's a dog. And I don't see nothing, so I keep walking. And all of a sudden, he is on me before I realized he was there. Black as night, Cane Corso. And I was like...
And they're humongous.
Yeah, he was like a foot away from me. He stepped out of the shadows and he's a foot away from me. And I was like, fuck. And I literally just stuck my hand out, let him sniff me. And I tossed the piece of pizza down. He looked up at me, looked at the pizza, rolled onto his back. I was like, what? And I started rubbing his belly tentatively, and I kind of moved the pizza over to him. From his back, he scarfed down that piece of pizza in one single
and
bite.
And that's great, but the problem with the Cane Corsos is the same reason why we have a problem with the American Pit Bulls. Everybody wants to talk about, well, my pit bull's a big puppy and he'd never hurt anybody. And that's true, 99.9% of the time. But pit bulls are still the number one fatal attackers. Everybody was like, well, the chihuahua attacks more people. Yeah, well, I'd rather be bit by 10 chihuahuas than one freaking pit bull.
My chihuahua. So don't
give me any crap. A pit bull bites me, I can pick it up and go throw against the wall and the fight's over.
Yeah.
You know, so, but the number one most fatal attacks or hospitalized attacks of dogs in the country and has been for a very long time is the American Pit Bull. And it comes from that same mentality. They will be that big puppy. And then almost like that fear response you're talking about, but it seems to trigger in weird places kind of sporadically and randomly amongst those types and the American Pitties is they'll just turn like that.
Yeah.
Not generally with their owners. Usually with the owner's kid, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Or the neighbor's kid or just a neighbor that comes over, has known this dog for 3 years and comes over and he's petted him the last 30 times he's been there. And then this time he just reaches down automatically and ruffles his ears and then gets his hand bit so bad that it breaks bones in his hand.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's just this switch that flips in their head and you don't know when it's going to
happen. They're still game dogs. It's still inside of them. And the big problem you have is that they will randomly, you might not deal with that, but they might get out one day. And then they maul your neighbor's Dalmatian or maul your neighbor's Pomeranian.
They're very fighty.
It's in them. It's very
dog. The American Pit Bull, if I'm recalling correctly, was originally a cattle dog. Made to be able to latch onto the legs of cattle and stuff like that and get them, bite them hard enough to get them to turn. A cow's big.
Yeah.
They can take a big bite, and it takes a big bite to make a cow pay attention.
Yeah.
And that's what their jaw lines were bred for. But then, of course, back when we were more brutal and did things for fun that were more brutal. We discovered that these dogs had a propensity for attacking one another, very territorial, and then they started fighting the dogs together and making bets because we were bored and wouldn't internet back in those days. So we would just have these two dogs kill each other.
Yeah.
Well, and then it became such a popular thing that we started breeding the dogs for that aggression.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, your dog might be a big old puppy and maybe it'll never hurt anybody its entire life, but its pedigree came from about 40 years of being bred specifically for attacking.
Yeah.
And you just don't know.
Well, I would never, ever, I have a game rat terrier. I've brought him up millions of times, but I would never trust that dog around someone's like pet rabbit. Yeah. There's no way. He will switch and kill it and you cannot stop him. And that dog is the most obedient. When I got him, he was a terror. He actually had the same issue where I flipped him over and he fought like he
was
going to
die. That's a terrier thing.
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah. I'll never forget this. We were like, he just won't learn. He snatched a ribeye steak off of my plate so fast. I didn't realize it was him that had done it. It was like this shocking, like, what just happened?
Yeah.
And I chased him down the hallway and took it back. I was like, no way. But he was so confused. And Ella finally, he would do this thing where he'd come up and beg for food. And she told it, she said, begging.
Yeah.
And she'd give him the treat. And I swear, one day, it was like you saw that little head cock.
Yeah.
Everything clicked. And it's after that, the obedience was there.
Yeah.
And one thing I do with my dog, I don't keep a lot of my dogs in the house, but occasionally I will. And when I keep a dog in the house, I always keep where I eat and where they eat separated. I give plenty of scraps. I'm fine with that. I don't allow begging. And whenever I give scraps, even if it's right there, I don't care if it's 2 feet away from where I was eating. It has a specific spot that it gets its food. To the point to where when I'm done with my plate and I stand up, if I have a house dog, it will run immediately to that, spot. Expecting to get it. You really shouldn't allow them to eat off the same thing you do.
Yeah.
Most of the time, it's not a big deal. But if you have a dog that it becomes a big deal, that's where you should go. You should create a specific spot that they eat, whether that's their food bowl or a specific spot in a hardwood floor or something like that that you don't mind getting a little greasy and have to wipe up. Yeah. You don't want to drop a piece of fat or something like that on the floor. Make a specific spot that that dog gets its scraps.
Yeah.
Don't feed them from your fingers.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, a lot of dogs, not a big deal. You know, they'll sit and beg and be pretty and stuff like that. But a lot of them, they'll start to push that envelope and they don't want to be up on you. And then you get closer and closer and you have to push them back. And it's just, it can be a slippery slope downhill, especially in them smaller breeds.
Mm-hmm.
And the smaller breeds you get, the more aggressive they are, typically speaking. The bigger breeds, even if they're more powerful and can be scarier, like a Rottweiler or a Doberman or something like that, they can. They're scary when they want to be, but they're slower acting. They're slower to act. They're less aggressive in general. Those small breeds, man, they're aggressive. They're fast acting, and they want it now, and they're used to taking what they need, and they've got that bred into them. They're bred for killing rats. They're bred for a lot of the terriers were sent down holes to push out weasels or push out rabbits for hunting or to kill the rats in the barn. I mean, there's just all these things where you got a 15-pound dog bred specifically to kill something that's half its weight.
Yeah.
That takes a lot. It takes a lot to do. I mean, could you imagine? I mean, I'm a 240-pound guy. If I went out with nothing I had, nothing but my teeth and my hands and killed something that was 120, I'd be a white-tailed doe. I'd be like me jumping on the back of a white-tailed doe and biting her to death.
Yeah. It's a good thing we learned how to use tools.
Yeah.
Sharpen things really helped us out.
But I mean, typically speaking, even like your coyotes and your wolves and stuff like that, they come down. The only reason why they bring down big game is because there's several of them doing it. A coyote or a wolf hunting by itself typically eats mice and rats and squirrels,
rabbits,
and stuff.
Quail,
small.
Yeah,
you know, the opportunistic things that they can grab quick and easy. And it's just. It's amazing that we've bred that much fighting power, that much killing instinct into something that weighs about 12 pounds.
12 pounds, yeah. Smokey is, I think he's skinny now. He's getting older.
I think that's why cats are such dicks, because they're 9 pounds, but they're the perfect killing machine.
Yeah.
And they're mad about it.
Yeah. So here's a question. Are cats ambush predators?
Yes, they are.
That's what I thought, because they don't have joints, so yeah, they have a hard time running.
Almost strictly, like a lion will hide in brush and wait for something. They will, of course, charge, but they typically take whatever they're charging within 50 yards or less. Yeah. If they don't get it within the first 50 yards, they give up because it's too much energy to expend. Yeah. Cheetahs are one of the very few developed the ability to run long distances, and their big advantage is the length of leg to body.
Yeah.
They don't expend as much energy to run that fast because they bunch their body up into this. Like, if you watch it in slow-mo of a cheetah running, their chest to butt ratio when they're bunched up together before they lunge forward is so small compared to how long they stretch their body.
So instead of having joints and being persistence runners, they're like a giant spring.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even at that, a cheetah will probably only, I mean, if it can't catch it within 100, 150 yards, it's probably going to It's all a matter of the amount of calories it takes to get it, as opposed to how many calories it's going to get from grabbing it. Leopards, jaguars, and mountain lions are all aerial ambush predators.
Yep.
Lions and tigers are both bush ambush predators. As far as I know, the only one that does a long distance chase is the cheetah.
It's a cheetah, yeah.
It's not cervids. That's a deer.
Servals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, servals, which is very close to the house cats. House cats, feral house cats, which are just horrific.
Yeah, the Florida wildcat is its own thing now.
Florida wildcat. There's so many. What's the one that looks like a tiny leopard? We actually have
Savannah.
The Savannah cat, but there's a different one, and I can't remember the name of it. We actually have them wild.
I think Jay has one at his house. He's probably going to hear this.
Arizona and New Mexico have some of these wildcats that I'm talking about, and they're all ambush predators, every single one of them.
That's what I thought.
They'll either be aerial ambush, like a bobcat is even often an aerial ambush. They'll do a little bit of both. Typically, when a bobcat is hunting something bigger than itself, it'll aerial ambush. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a dichotomy there. With the two different styles for cat killing, but whenever it's doing more like killing quail or squirrel or something like that, then it'll hide in a bush and wait for it to get close enough. But yeah, cats are almost always ambush killers.
Yeah, they don't have we are the polar opposite. So we have a super developed sweat system.
Yeah,
and our eyes are in the front of our head, and we have excellent distance vision. We are persistence hunters,
and that's why we have big butts.
Yes, because we will literally.
I can't lie.
That's why we like them. Yeah. We cannot lie. We want to raise better hunters. It's in our genes, and conservation is in our genes because I think as a human species, we understand that we need to keep this in balance. And if you love it and enjoy being in it, if you like taking game, you're going to be the one that's invested in keeping it.
Even if the idea of taking something's life to sustain yourself or your family makes you uneasy, please get out. Please get out and enjoy it. Please understand the cycle of life. Yeah. If you don't like it, please understand that we do.
Yeah.
I don't enjoy the death of it. I have many times sat with a deer that I've killed. I don't weep over it, but I have many times sat with a deer that I've killed and sat and petted it and felt a sense of loss that it was gone. It doesn't mean I didn't very much enjoy my part of the food chain.
Yeah.
I very much enjoy being part of nature. I enjoyed being out there and watching the day awaken. I enjoyed watching the deer come out. I enjoyed the fact that I was the apex predator in that situation. But that doesn't mean that there isn't pretty often a sense of loss when it hits there. I mean, I don't sit and weep over everyone. I don't pray over everyone or anything like that. It's a cycle of life. If I didn't get it 2 years from now, a coyote would have got it, or a mountain lion would have got it, or a bobcat or a car got hit by a car, or it got EHD and died a slow, horrible, painful death. Something was going to get it. Something's going to get all of us. I enjoy being a part of the system that I have developed to be in.
Yeah.
So don't dismiss it right off the bat. Go out and observe. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't feel comfortable being an active part of it, be an observing part of it. If you observe long enough, I think you'll understand just where we come from. Even if you just want to go out and take pictures, if you want to go out and find the different fungi and just be amazed at how many hundreds of types of fungi we have just in our little backwoods, just in a little, if you got a 1 acre lot behind your house that you can go in. And I can promise you that there is not a person that could possibly be listening to this podcast in America. I can't speak for overseas. I know we have a few of those. But and there's nobody in this podcast that isn't within an hour's worth drive of public land.
Yeah.
We've done such an amazing job in this country of preserving public land that everybody owns. And you can go there for whatever reason you want to.
Yep.
If you just want to go hike and enjoy, watch the leaves, look at the fungus, watch how this animal interacts with that animal. Pay attention to what plants are getting eaten more than other plants.
Mm-hmm.
What ones are going to be in most danger if we have way too many deer. I mean, there's just so much to it. And there's one thing that I wanted to bring up, and it's a slightly long-winded thing. But we live in a time right now, and I'm sure this has been the case in everybody's time, but it's kind of astonished me the more I've gotten to realize it, just how much our world has changed just in our small ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
The black bear.
Yep.
Has for about the last decade enjoyed a population increase of about 10% a year. The black bear, for whatever reason, has adapted to the world we live in right now better than just about any species in the world, and they are exploding. We've had multiple sightings of black bears in Indiana, and we haven't had black bears in Indiana since Daniel Boone's time.
Yeah.
They were extirpated so quickly and easily from Indiana by people with black powder rifles, yeah, and extirpated from the country, from the state. They're the second most widespread big game animal, but they are the fastest growing in population big game animal, not countrywide, continent-wide. They're in Canada, they're in the United States, they're in Mexico. They're just exploding. And they're not the only thing. The bobcat.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have many black bears right now. We have an occasional sighting here and there.
Yeah, we have one that was walking.
Yeah. There was one walking. There's one that's been living in the Big Oaks National Wildlife Refuge that we've never observed leave. And we just keep getting sightings of it pop up about every 6 months or so because he just moved there and stayed. And right now it's just young juvenile males.
Uh-huh.
And you know that they get pushed out by the other ones in hopes of finding a female here and there, and most likely that one will pass on without ever finding a female. But I can just about guarantee you that within 5 years,
I feel you, bear.
Yeah, he's a free bear. I can just about guarantee you within 5 years we'll have enough population growth between Ohio, Kentucky, and Michigan that we'll have a breeding population. We'll have a female that gives birth to cubs in Indiana within 5 years. And we've seen it happen with bobcats. Bobcats got nearly extirpated from the state. They were never completely gone like black bears were. But they got nearly extirpated from the state. And we've got so many bobcats now. I see them every year. Every year I see bobcats now. And I remember the first time I ever seen one. It was just a mind-boggling experience. Yeah. And then I started doing more research into it. And I'm like, oh, yeah, well, they're nocturnal. So for every one people see, there's 10 in that same woods. Yeah.
They sound like a woman screaming. One of the scariest things that ever happened to me as a child.
I was convinced that Kimberly Lake had a witch on it.
Yeah. Yes.
That had a bobcat on it.
It's like a kid.
Yes, because you'd hear raccoons fight and possums rustle and stuff. And then one time I'm back there and there's that. And I'm like,
what the hell is that?
As a small child, I was absolutely convinced there's a witch on Kimberly Lake. One of the articles I read, 2016 or 17, I thought really showed how connected everything is in nature. So I believe it was 15 or 20 American bison were released just wild in the middle of central Indiana, which used to be plains. Well, just in the 3 years that they had been out there, by the time I read the article, it had been 3 years, they had transformed the land back into plains.
Yeah.
Because the way their hooves cut the ground allows for certain grasses to grow, but other grasses not to grow.
Uh-huh.
And they literally built their own environment. with their hooves.
That's phenomenal.
It's amazing to me.
It's the same thing with the oxen and stuff up north in the tundra areas. We've killed so many of them off, and so many of them have died off, that there's a lot of permafrost area that everybody wants to talk about the global warming and stuff like that. Well, a lot of that permafrost area was never permafrost when the wild lived there. Yeah. It was grassland. It was savanna land.
Yeah. And when you get into like the eastern steppes, especially.
Yeah, exactly. Especially up in like Russia and stuff. And that was one of the biggest things is it's hooved herbivores.
Yeah.
Especially cloven hooved herbivores will actually change how the plant life grows on a plane and actually promote the same grass that they eat.
Yeah.
It's clump grass. Yeah. The problem is we have imported, once again, an exotic species. Fescue is not a native grass.
Yeah.
It was never meant to be here. It is a green desert that almost nothing eats nor lives in.
Yeah.
Fescue is one of the most horrible things you could have ever done to the ecosystem around here. It was brought in by farmers because it has an incredible root system. It's almost impossible to wash away. So they put it in their field edges and stuff to keep erosion from happening. Yeah. But the problem is it spreads like wildfire, and now it's almost everywhere. Well, you get these hooved animals in that walk across these areas that will actually, they dig in enough to kill, they walk across enough to kill out and keep the fescue from overtaking an area and allow the clump grass to come in. Mm. And the clump grass is one of the biggest, the lack of clump grass is one of the biggest reasons why we're losing all of our ground nesting animals, our rabbits, our quail, stuff like that, that normally nest in ground because they have to make their nest in these ground, but they have to be able to run. Like a quail can fly, obviously.
Yeah.
But it gets most of its escape from predators on the ground.
Yeah, they run.
They'll run, and then they start to scatter, and then they fly in different directions.
Yeah, if you've ever flushed a cubby, you'll have seen that. They'll shoot off in different directions.
Well, they can't do that. They can't spread out. If they're clumped up in something like fescue, they're stuck. They're in a tangle. They have only one option, and that's a very slow takeoff from the ground.
Yeah.
And so many things around in this country, at least... When you're talking below 5 pounds, rabbits, ground nesting birds, stuff like that, they require that clump grass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just, it not only is it a big thing for their breeding and habitat, but a lot of the things in North America evolved to eat only that.
Yeah.
So we're not only taking away the nesting behavior, the nesting behaviors of these ground nesting birds and rabbits and stuff like that, but we're taking away their protection from aerial predators or protection from ground predators. We're taking away the food that we have for most of the animals that lived here for the longest period of time. And we have terraformed this country so bad to where we've only made it inhabitable for just a handful of things.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I want to close out on this one. This is another type of conservation that nobody thinks about. I have been planning for the last several years. I actually collected a large amount of them, but they ended up, Josie, my dog, stepped on them, and they ended up going bad. I've collected pawpaws.
Oh, okay.
The Indiana banana, the only native fruit to Indiana. So the way this story comes about is we would go to these family get-togethers of Ella's at the time, and there was always persimmon pudding, and Ella was like, I hate persimmon pudding because when we were kids we thought it was brownies. Well, I was like, this is unreal, like this is so good. So one year there's no persimmon pudding, and I'm like, hey, which one of your aunts made the persimmon pudding? She's like, my aunts didn't, my grandma did. Her grandma was in her 90s.
Yeah.
So that recipe died with her.
Sucks.
And I have right now 4 Fuya persimmons. They're not local. I would like to get some local ones because the local ones are brown. They'll look like a brownie.
I've got Fuya, 3 persimmon trees on my property.
There we go. I'll get with you. The Fuya tree are orange, so they make an orange persimmon pudding. Yep. But it took me about 3 tries, and we got it. We got so close to that recipe, as close as we're ever going to get. But the one thing I've never had anybody offer me is a pawpaw.
And the Dryden Family Farm actually has a small pawpaw grove.
Yeah, I'm going to... This next year, coming up here soon, I am going to collect and make a pawpaw pie, which is mostly sugar. I'm not going to lie to you guys. It's not a healthy option.
It's all
but
pies.
It's what I want to make, and they're so delicious. They're like a custard apple.
Yeah.
Very interesting. If you've never had one, they're probably dropping in the woods local to you, and you don't even know it.
Usually around the end of August, early September, they're ripe. They call them the Indiana banana for a reason. Is because that the flesh to them is very banana-like, a ripe banana.
Very yellow.
They're very seedy, so you have to make sure you strain those seeds out. But the seeds are big.
Giant seeds. Yeah.
It's easy to strain them out, but there's a lot of seeds in them. But very good. If you catch one when it's ripe, they're amazing.
It's unreal.
Yeah. I've ate them so many times out while I was squirrel hunting or something like that, and just pull them off, and you just feel them, and they're just... They get ripe just like a banana too.
They do. They get soft.
They're either way too hard, and then they hit that soft spot. It's just like a banana because you get like they're unripe for about 6 weeks, and then you get about 24 hours.
That's it. Bananas and avocados.
Yeah,
you got to hit that over to window.
Avocados are best when they're.
I've never had a dessert made out of them. If you get to make a dessert out of them, I'd love.
It's gonna happen. It's gonna happen. This is my niche in life now. It kind of put more emphasis on this. Like I said, I even collected them. Ryan Calhoun, he collected them for me. He has a grove out where he lives, so I would have got some this year, but again, a lot happened, so I missed that window, so we're going to do it. But guys, I hope you all enjoyed this episode. We are going to follow up on this. We did a long episode for you. I'm glad to be back. I mean, life's got in the way of all of us, but we're expanding the team, as you see. The Viking has been really consistent and coming and has a lot to add. And
I'm glad to be here. It's been very enjoyable.
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that. So all you throwaway kids out there listening, get on the Facebook page. Let us know how you feel. Let us know you listen to our episodes.
I do want to give a shout out to juror number 3. I was just recently a juror in a trial. And had a throwaway kid in the juror room with me.
I think I know who that was. I do believe I know who that was.
So, but yes, get
juror number 3, if you hear this, word up.
Yeah.
Get on the page. So far, only my wife has made a suggestion on what we should do. And it's a good suggestion.
We're going to do it.
And we'll, give us suggestions. Tell us what you want to hear more about. It doesn't have to be something that we specifically know anything about. We'll research it and then gab on for an hour about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine. Let us know how you liked it.
Yeah.
What you want to know more about. You talk about... conservation is something that I could talk for a week about, so I've only barely just tapped my toe into it. If there's anything you want to know more about, ask me.
Yep.
If I don't know about it, I will let you know. I will research it and find out. And that's just one thing of 1,000 things. I could pick 10 things out of Justin's mind right now. Whatever you want to know, let us know. Yep. Let us know how you liked it.
So, guys, thanks everyone again for tuning in. We will see you on Facebook. Yeah. Stay weird.
Yeah.
Keep listening and have a good one.
Keep on dumpster diving.
Yeah.